I'm sorry, John, there's no Beatles song this week. That series is done. But we begin this Sunday a brand new sermon series. It is our Lent sermon series, these 40 days that we have to prepare ourselves for the celebration of resurrection. But before resurrection, we know there has to be betrayal and trial and crucifixion and burial. But our sermon series for this Lent is called Imperfect People, Perfect Results. Imperfect People, Perfect Results. And the Bible is full of stories of people who are less than perfect. Let's think about this word just for a minute. We have it up on the screen. Imperfect. Imperfect means, you know, it has blemish or it falls short of being what is ultimately perfect. And I hate to blow it to you, but it's not going to hurt as much as it did on Ash Wednesday when I said you're all going to die, which you all are. But not a single one of you is perfect. And if you're thinking to yourself right now, you are perfect, maybe you even leaned over and already told your spouse or the person you came with, I'm perfect, it's your humility that is keeping you from truly, or your lack of humility that is keeping you from being perfect. And yet John Wesley came around and started talking about Christian perfection. He believed Christian perfection was possible and defined it as a heart that is made perfect in love. And yet we know that by ourselves we can't do it. But it doesn't take much. If we are clay in the potter's hands and we allow Jesus to work us, to mold us, to shape us, to inspire us, then with very little change, imperfect can become, I'm perfect. I'm perfect. And the only way we can ever get to a place where we can say that is if we allow the love, the grace, the power of Christ through the Holy Spirit to be made manifest in and through us. I would like to now just list my imperfections, but we don't have enough time for all of that. I acknowledge them. But today we look at an imperfect person named Jacob. And Jacob, his story is fascinating in that we have the entire story. He is one of the few people in the scriptures that we are introduced to before he is born. We can track each and every stage of his life all the way up to his death. And then even after death, we know what happens with his remains as they are brought back to the land that God has promised him. This incredible story. He is one of the patriarchs. He is the third part of God's plan to develop this nation that is ultimately the womb that produces Jesus Christ. If you read the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 1, there's the genealogy of Jesus, and Jacob is listed in that genealogy. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob. And we're going to hear who Jacob marries in a little bit. The success of God's plan, however, was more often in spite of rather than Jacob's life. Jacob's life. No, it was not that way. Before Jacob was born, God promised that this plan would be worked out through Jacob, not the other way around. If you've already opened up your pew Bible, there's a verse before the verse that I'm actually going to begin reading with, in which God is talking to Rebekah, who is going to be Jacob's mother. And in verse 23 of chapter 25, God comes to Rebekah and says, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. One shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. Which is scandalous, because that's not how it happened in that part of the world at that time. And although, as we're going to see, Jacob's methods were not always, shall I say, respectable, certainly not perfect, his skill, determination, and patience really should be admired. As we follow him from birth to death, we're going to see God at work in and through him. Now, I went to our church library this week. How many of you have ever been into our church library? I went into our church library, as I often do, and because they have some study Bibles in there that I don't currently own, and I opened up the Life Application Study Bible. That's a very, very popular study Bible, and it's a great tool for you to use in your own Bible study. And I went to the part on Jacob, and they had a full page that just talked about Jacob that wasn't scripture, and they broke Jacob's life up into four unique stages. And so what I want to do is I want to shape today's message by looking at these four stages of his life, and then draw some lessons from each and every one of those stages. So in the first stage of Jacob's life, he lives up to his name. In the Bible, names always have meanings. And the Hebraic meaning of the name Jacob is he grasps the heel, or it is also means he deceives, or my favorite definition of Jacob, and I'm sure that Tony and Sue didn't name you Jacob after this, the schemer, the one who schemes. And so we have this text from Genesis chapter 25, verses 24 through 34. When her time, her being Rebecca, came to give birth, was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first one came out red, and his body like a hairy mantle, so they named him Esau. Afterwards, his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. And we know that the first one out, the eldest son, is going to get everything in that day and age. And it's still that way with a lot of families, still that way a lot around the world. In the Hadley family tree, it was that way as well. I have done some genealogical work, and I had a great-great-grandfather that his wife died during childbirth, and he got remarried and had a slew of additional children, including my ancestor. And when he died, the eldest Hadley got everything except for $1 was given to all the other sons. Daughters got nothing. Very old school. This explains my poverty level right now. My course was changed with that decision a long time ago. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. I want to pause right there. Esau, he's a man's man. Jacob, kind of a mama's boy. Kind of a mama's boy in the tents where the women would hang out. Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, that's not man's work in that day and age. When Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob with great eloquence, "Let me eat some of that red stuff, for I am famished. I am starving." And so the story continues. Therefore, he was called Edom. And we know that his ancestors are going to be the Edomites. Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Now this last sentence is kind of a throwaway sentence to you and I, but it says everything in that culture. Thus Esau despised his birthright. The word of God for the people of God, thanks be to God. You don't despise your birthright if you are the oldest son in a family. It just doesn't happen. And so Esau sells his birthright, sells. Now Isaac continues to age. The boys have grown up. We're told in Scripture that he was 60 when they were born. We don't know exactly how old he is now, but he is an old man. He is frail. He is kind of to his bed and to a chair. He has lost all his sight. He can't see. And he knows that it's time to pass this blessing, to pass this birthright along, to kind of hand off the baton to the eldest male for the next generation to continue to move forward as God's people. And so he sends Esau out to go hunting, to have some game so this can be done over a meal. And Rebekah overhears this. Tents have thin walls. And so Rebekah hears it, and so she grabs Jacob, and she says, "Here's what we're going to do. Your brother's going to go out. He's going to try and hunt and make this meal, and then we're going to this birthright's going to be passed on. What I want you to do is to put on some of Esau's stinky clothes, and we're going to put this hair on your arms, because he's a hairy guy. You kind of have smooth, glowing skin. And when we're going to go, you're going to go in there, you're going to pretend that you are Esau, and you are going to steal that birthright." Jacob says, "Okay, so They quick prepare a meal. He puts on the clothes. He makes sure that he smells like his brother. He makes sure he feels like his brother. And he goes into his father's chamber, and the blessing is about to happen. And Isaac's like, come here, come near. And he smells him. He touches his arms, smells like Esau, feels like Esau. But Isaac was, he said, are you really Esau? To which Jacob says, yes, yes I am. To which I say, liar, liar, pants on fire. At my last church, I did a sermon series called Liar, Liar, Pants on Fire. We looked at some of the great lies that are told in the Bible, and there are some fantastic lies told in the Bible. Even Abraham says of his wife, Sarah, oh, she's my sister. She's my sister. What would it look like if, as people drove past Silver Spring, past the United Methodist Church of Whitefish Bay, we had on the thing there, the Bible's full of lies? I don't think that would go over well at all. It wouldn't go over well at all. And so the birthright is stolen. Esau comes back from the field and he hears what's going on. He goes to his father and says, well, bless me too. Bless me too. And the father says, I'm sorry. What is done is done. It has happened. It's too late. And so Esau looks at his brother and says, as soon as dad dies, you die. As soon as dad dies, you die. And Rebecca, who is overhearing all of this, you know, she says, look, son, you got to get out of here. Go to the land of my people. And while you're there, marry a nice girl from that area. The women here, I just can't handle these women. And so he agrees to do it. He swears he'll never marry a Canaanite woman. And so Esau, who is so bitter, who is so filled with rage at this point, when he learns that his parents despise Canaanite women, what do you think he does? Marries a Canaanite woman, the first one he sees, marries her. And so Esau had his heel grabbed by Jacob in birth, and then had his birthright and blessing grabbed away from him. And now Jacob is on the run. He's on the run. And during this run, he has this powerful encounter, and the image up on the screen is from that encounter. It is at a place called Bethel, and it is a powerful encounter because it's the first experience Jacob has ever had with God, a real experience where God speaks to him, God makes everything known to him. And so he names this place Bethel, which means God's house, the place where God dwells. It is right here. And even though Jacob's going to continue to be imperfect for the rest of his life, he's never going to forget that touch. He's never going to stop seeking the touch of God, to listen for God's voice. Esau despised his birthright is the real takeaway from this. And we know that God never calls us to be less than honest. But Jesus, when he was sending out the disciples, said, I want you to be shrewd as snakes and yet innocent as doves. And what a fine line that is, that we sometimes navigate incorrectly, focusing on the shrewdness instead of the innocence. So the second stage of Jacob's life is what I would call girls, girls, girls. He falls in love. He is on his way out and he sees this girl, Rachel, and he is like, oh, I am gone. I am smitten. I've got to have this girl. And so he goes to talk to her father. He has no money. And again, this is a day and age where this was a financial arrangement to get the person you want to marry. And he has nothing. And so Laban, that's the father's name, says, tell you what, if you work for me for 7 years, I'll give you this daughter right now. And so he's ready to sign up, right? Deal. And so the day of the wedding comes and the bride is there and she's wearing the traditional veil and they go through the wedding. And this was a day and age where you would have this wedding tent and then the couple was immediately supposed to go to the tent next to it to consummate the marriage. No pressure right there. Again, tents have thin walls. So, you know, they're just supposed to go there and do this. It happens. The marriage is now sealed. It's a done deal. And then when they come out of the tent, he realizes it wasn't Rachel at all. That guy schemed the schemer. It's her older sister, Leah. Now, I'm so glad that Leah Gaffney's not here. Do you know what the Hebraic word for Leah really means? Cow. It means cow. I'm not making that up. I can't make stuff like that up. And Rachel means you, a beautiful, innocent dove, or not dove, a little lamb. And so Jacob, who has been scammed, it's kind of a karmic act, and he goes and he says, you know what, you duped me. I want Rachel. And Laban says, well, that'll cost you 7 more years. You really willing to work for 14 years for me? You can have her. So he has these two women as wives, and they immediately begin this race to have male sons, because that's what was important in that day and age. And so the story continues. Jacob experienced life from the other side. But do we notice the growth in Jacob? Jacob in stage one of life would have just run away. But because of this powerful encounter at Bethel, now Jacob is not going to leave until he knows it is what God's plan for him is, that he has God's permission. So finally the time comes, and God has said, you know, you can go. And so he goes to Laban and says, I'm going to leave. And in the time that Jacob had been there with him, Laban became wealthier than he could ever have imagined. And so they have this settlement. You can take part of the flock, but you only take the part of the animals that have spots, because they're ugly, they're not worth as much. But what Laban didn't know was that Jacob understood how through breeding to have the stronger animals, the animals that really were more valuable and had more worth, to have spots on them. And so he duped Laban. So this, can you imagine what Christmas dinner would have been like at a family like that? Everyone's trying to stab each other in the back. And so he runs away. He's got the great cattle. He's got the women. He's got some sons. He's got some daughters. And they go away, and Laban chases after him. So not only does he have Esau who wants to kill him, now he has Laban hot on his back. You deceive me, said the deceiver to another deceiver. You know, I don't know if I believe in karma or not, but Jesus says, you know, the judgment you use is the judgment that's going to be used against you. He got what he had coming. And so in the third stage of life, stage one, he was the grabber. He grabbed the heel. He grabbed the birthright. Second stage was girls, girls, girls. He falls in love and gets duped. In the third stage, again, there's going to be grabbing. So he realizes a very mature thing, and maybe some of you need to do this. He knows he needs to reconcile with his grown brother. To really have peace, he knows he needs this reconciliation. So he sends word out that he wants to reconcile, to bury the hatchet, hopefully not in his own back. And so they agree to meet on the other side of this river. And so Jacob, ever the schemer, the planner, the schemer, he says, okay, I have no idea if we're going to get slaughtered once we get across this river. So you know what he did? He sent Leah and her children first out in front. And then he sent Rachel and the kids, and he himself stayed back on the other side. And while he's back on the other side that night, the night before he was going to reconcile with his brother, he encounters a holy visitor, and they engage in a wrestling match. Now, friends, whether this wrestling match was a physical encounter or a spiritual one, I know many of you have been wrestling with God for decades. And so he's wrestling with this figure, and he says, give me a blessing, give me a blessing, give me a blessing. And finally, the angel just touches him on the hip, which throws it out, which is going to cause him to limp for the rest of his life. And yet he receives that blessing, and a part of that blessing comes a change of name. Remember, Hebrew names mean so much, and his name becomes Israel. Israel, which means he has wrestled with man and with God. And if we look at the history of our Israelite brothers and sisters, they indeed have wrestled with some real monsters, continue to wrestle to this day, both with man and with God. So he walks forever with a limp, but he walks with the blessing because he refused to let go of God. He just refused to let go. His relationship to God becomes the essential part of his life. Don't let go. And so we come to the final stage of Jacob's life. And again, he's grabbed, but he's grabbed forever because God has achieved a firm hold on him. Is he perfect yet? No. Not by any means. No, he is still not perfect. I mean, he played favorites. His son, Donny Osmond, I mean, his son, Joseph, is so important to him that the other brothers resent it. They beat him up, throw him in a hole, and sell him. And that's the imperfect people we're going to look at next week, Joseph's brothers. But he still is striving with God. And he has this invitation to save his life because of the famine to go to Egypt, but he still won't go until God has said yes. And we know he dies there in Egypt, and we know that his remains are brought back to the motherland, brought back to the promised land. And so, yes, he is imperfect. He's a deceiver. My guess is, if your name was Leah, you would say he was a terrible husband, kind of a hard father, loving one so much more than the other. He did focus on wealth for personal sake. But despite all this, he was in tune with God. At key moments in his life, he had the ability to listen to God. He refused to let go. He was always open to the touch of God. And friends, that's the lesson for us. You and I, filled with our flaws, filled with our imperfections, and yet we can still be blessed if we refuse to let go. Even if it means that it feels like we are wrestling with God, do not let go, because I promise you, you will be blessed. And Jacob was indeed blessed. And so people have been speaking of him as long as there have been people born after him. Hundreds of years after he was born, a prophet named Hosea said this: "In the womb he tried to supplant his brother, and in his manhood, he strove with God." This is Hosea chapter 12, verses 3 through 6. "He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He met him at Bethel, and there he spoke with him. Him, the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. But as for you," this is what Hosea is saying to the people, and it's what I am saying to you this morning, "but as for you, return to your God. Hold fast to love and to justice, and wait continually for your God." And so in this season of Lent, I want you to meditate and to reflect on the way in which maybe you have been loosening your grip, the ways in which you have stopped looking for the holy in the ordinary. Look for ways that you can grow in your faith. And so one of the things that we can do in this season is to grow in our faith through spiritual acts, through our spiritual disciplines. And so we know that on the night in which Jesus was ultimately betrayed, which led to trial and persecution, it led to beatings, and ultimately led to the cross, he was gathered in a room with 12 other guys, all of whom's lineage goes back to the sons of Jacob, who had his name changed to Israel. He took something ordinary and turned it into something extraordinary. He took a loaf of bread and he broke it, and he said, "This is my body, which is given for you. Take and eat in remembrance of me." And the loaf worked its way around the room. When the meal was over, he took one of the containers of wine. He said a prayer of thanksgiving, and then he said, "This is the cup of the new covenant, poured out for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. As often as you drink it in remembrance of me." And so from that day forward, this act has sustained the life of Christian worship, and we're going to have an opportunity to partake in this day. You don't need to be a member here of this local church. You don't need to be a member of a United Methodist church. You don't need to be a member of a church anywhere. You are a child of God, and so everyone is welcome to come forward, to place your offerings at the front of the building, or the front of the pews. There'll be a gluten-free station right here, and then there will be regular bread stations on the other side. You are invited to receive a portion of the loaf, to dip it into the cup, and to partake. And so would you please pause with me as I pray God's blessing upon these elements?